opened onto a laneway that was just wide enough to let a car through. And the gate, or the doorway, the front door to the neighbouring house, was on the other side of the laneway, immediately opposite our gateway. And one morning, early in the morning, I was taking the rubbish down to the street to be collected. And as I was coming back towards my gateway, the man in the neighbouring house came out of his door on his way to work. And when he saw me, he took one look, turned in his tracks, and went back inside. And I thought, this is a bit strange, because we know each other and we're on good terms, but it was quite clear that seeing me made him go back home. And so I went in to ask the nun whom I lived with, what was all this about? I explained what had happened, and she smiled and she said, yes, he did go back inside because he saw you, because he thought it was a bad omen, because he was going to work. He was going out to make his daily bread. And the first person that he should see out of his house is someone who has no money, who has to rely on other people to give them the food that they eat and a place to live. And that's not a good sign of prosperity at all. And he thought that was a bad start to his day. And I was quite surprised, because this was a Buddhist country and I'm a Buddhist nun and he's a Buddhist, so why doesn't he want to see me first thing in the morning? But anyhow, it was a learning experience. And as it happened that evening, his wife came to see us, and she confirmed what the nun had said. Yes, he had been put off because he'd seen you first thing in the morning, and he came back in and told me what had happened. And his wife had said to him, oh no, she's a good one, that nun's a good one, don't worry about it, don't be put off, go off to work. And so he'd taken a bit of confidence from what his wife had said, and he'd gone off to work. And what had happened was that as he'd been going to work, he'd found 200 rupees on the road. And this was completely contrary to his expectations because of the bad omen that he'd encountered first thing in the morning. And so she was coming to tell me, and to tell us, what had happened, because it was quite a joke, because he thought he was going to have a terrible day, and it actually turned out to be better than normal. And this is an interesting story and an interesting experience to reflect on, because all of us, very often, we look around for good omens, good signs of how our life is going to be, what kind of days are going to be, what kind of year is it going to be. And sometimes we look for the omen, we think the Dow Jones Index might be a good omen for us and might be pointing to our future happiness and prosperity. We're all looking around, and it's an interesting sign of our self-centeredness, the way we think that we're the centre of the world, that we can look at facts outside ourselves, things that are happening in the world, and actually assume that they refer to our personal state of well-being. And this happens in modern society, it happens in Sri Lanka, and it happened in the time of the Buddha. And people would often come to the Buddha with questions about good omens, and what were the good signs, what were the signs or the things that would lead to prosperity and happiness and safety. And so tonight I'd like to talk about one of the teachings that the Buddha gave specifically in reply to a question that was put to him about what are the highest blessings in life, what are the good omens. And this question was put to the Buddha by a deva. If you've not heard that word before, you may wonder what it refers to. In Buddhism, the Buddha taught, and people have experienced, that there are realms of beings, not only human beings, higher and lower realms of existence. Animals, for example, are a lower realm to human beings. And higher realms, beings live who have fine material form and who exist in different realms where they experience pleasure, where they experience the fruits of good action in previous births. And these, one of these realms is the Deva realm. And these beings used to listen to the Buddha's teachings. And one of the things that we say is one of the qualities of the Buddha and the Dharma is that the Buddha was teaching not only human beings, but higher beings as well. And they would not only listen to the Buddha's teaching, but they would come and ask him questions about the Dharma. And they would usually come late at night, after midnight, when most of the humans had gone to bed. And this particular night, this Deva came to ask the Buddha, "What are the good omens?" And he'd been given the job of coming to ask the Buddha because not only human beings, but the higher beings were also asking, "How can we ensure our safety and our prosperity? How can we prolong the good fortune that we're experiencing?" And there were all sorts of views and opinions about how to do this. And so this was a question which only the Buddha, they felt, could give a satisfactory or complete answer to. And so this was the question that was put to the Buddha. And it's not unlike the questions that most of us have in our heart. How can we guarantee happiness, prosperity and safety for ourselves and for those we care about? And the Buddha's reply turned around the concept of what was a good omen from being something that arises outside of oneself to being the result of one's own good actions, the cultivation of one's own mind and heart, and the fulfillment of one's social obligations, fulfillment of one's responsibilities, creating a healthy environment in which to live and which to share with others. And the Buddha enumerated 38 conditions, which he said are really the best blessings that we can experience in life. And there are a few points about this list of blessings. They start off with very mundane things, moving through, setting oneself on a firm foundation in life, and developing one's worldly skills, and then cultivating one's inner qualities, and moving towards final liberation through the development of wisdom. And so this teaching gives a very complete but graduated path of practice which we can all use as a guideline in our own life. So it's a very complete path, and we see that as we walk it, we see more and more depth in it, even in the beginning stages, if you like, of the development of worldly skills and worldly relationships. And it's a sutta, a teaching, which is one of the ones that is very much loved in traditional Buddhist societies. It's called in Pali the Maha Mangala Sutta, and it's one which is very often recited by monks and nuns or by people who know it, especially on happy occasions like weddings or births or things that people want to celebrate, because it gives a very clear teaching. But it can only really be helpful to us personally if we understand what the teaching is, and more importantly, if we then put it into practice in our own life. So that's why I thought I would speak about it tonight. If you were here at the Vesak celebrations last week, you will have heard this chanting. It was in the community hall before the meal. The Bhikkhu Sangha and myself chanted this as a blessing for the people who were here. And it's the chant that starts, Asewana Chabala Nang, panditanam cha sevana. So if you're familiar with any of the chanting, that's the one it is, and that's the one I'm going to talk about. And go through the verses as they were presented by the Buddha. And the first of the verses talks about associating with the wise and not associating with the foolish, and paying respects to those who are worthy of respect. And this is a very good starting point for us to reflect on, because first of all we have to know who are the wise that we should be associating with. Perhaps it was easier in the time of the Buddha, because we could say, well, the Buddha was the wise one, and the enlightened monks and nuns that were around him, they were the wise ones. And so it's clear these are the ones that we should associate with if we want to know the truth and we want to have clear instructions on how to be happy, how to find safety and prosperity in our own life. But these days it's more difficult to know who's really wise. First of all, we have to distinguish wisdom from being clever, because these days human beings are very clever. They can do lots of things, create lots of things, change lots of things, but that doesn't mean that they're wise. The Buddha said you can tell a wise person by their speech and also by their action, and that's how you should judge a person, not by their title or who they say they are or where they come from or colour of their skin, but from their actions. And when we look at those who are wise, we see that when they speak and give advice and speak from experience, they talk not as though they live in isolation from other beings. Wise people know that we live always in relationships and in connection with others. And so when they give advice, they give that advice mindful of the consequences of what they're saying. And this is one of the ways that we judge our own behaviour. What will be the effect of what I'm going to do or what I'm going to say on myself, on my mind, now and in the future? And what will be the effect, the consequences for people around me who are involved in this now and in the future? And so this is one of the yardsticks, if you like, that we can use to measure whether a person is wise or not. It's still not going to be easy. You'll have to probably listen to their advice or know them over a period of time to see really whether what they say is based on wisdom, on true knowing, or whether it's based in desire, in greed, in aversion. Not to associate with those who are foolish. This is becoming more difficult these days, because the whole world comes into our living room through the mass media, television, videos, on the internet. We can be in touch with all sorts of things and all sorts of people. And very often we're not even in a position to stop it, in a sense that other people in the household might be inviting foolish ones into our household, and we don't like it, but we can't stop it. And so this is something that we have to reflect on very much, the effect of the kind of associations that we keep on the way that they stir us up. If they stir up our emotions, the teaching is that the emotions cloud the mind and make it more difficult to think clearly, and we know this from our own experience. So if we're constantly being influenced by those who stir up our emotions, stir up our likes and our dislikes, then we need to be careful, because that makes it difficult for us to think straight, difficult for us to discern what is for our own good and what is for our harm. And the next of these real blessings in life, the Buddha said, is to pay respects to those who are worthy of respect. And this again forces us to examine our own values, our own priorities. What do we really value in life? What do we think is worthy of respect? Someone's wisdom or someone's power? Someone's wealth or someone's generosity? And also for us to reflect on, who is it that I can pay respect to? Do I have the capacity within myself to acknowledge that there are people who have more wisdom than I do, or more worldly knowledge and experience than I do? Can I actually pay respect to someone else? Throughout this teaching, as we go along this path, and particularly in this teaching of the Mahamangala Sutta, the Buddha comes back over and over again to pride, to reflecting on pride in our mental makeup, and seeing the effect that it has on our ability to relate with other people, and also our ability to learn knowledge, and also to develop spiritually. And so one of the things we can ask right at the beginning is, who can I bow my head to? We all identify so much with this top part of the body as who we are. When we look in the mirror, that's who I am, there I am, staring back. And so who can I put my head down to in this life? And again, this is something for us to reflect on. What I like about this sutta is that we have to reflect on it. We have to find what it's saying to us, and to also reflect what's the Buddha pointing to as the way to be really happy and safe. And am I prepared, am I willing to go on that path? The next verse is, to live in a suitable locality, to have done good karma, good deeds in the past, and to set oneself on the right path in this present life. So this next verse, after we sort of establish the foundation of who we're spending our time with, the wise or the foolish, and whether we're willing to open to that, is then, am I in the right place for doing that? Am I in a place which is going to support that? And if we look around at our experience in Perth, the opportunity that we have to come to a place like this, to be in contact with the teaching and teachers, then we can think, this is a very good situation. And this living in a suitable locality refers not only to access to the Dharma, but it means also living in an environment which makes it possible for us to put our attention on the Dharma. So we're living in an environment which is relatively free from friction, not subject to war, not subject to famine, to a place, in a place where we can go to listen to the Buddha's teachings without fear that we're going to be ostracised by the community, or that we're going to lose our job because we're a Buddhist. And so from all these perspectives, we're living in a very suitable locality. And the next one, having done good deeds in the past. And according to the Buddha's teaching, we are supported by those good deeds in our present life. And those good deeds have brought us to this very fortunate situation. And not only the fortunate situation, but fortunate birth as a human being, with the sense faculties working, with an intelligent mind that can reflect on the teaching, that can understand the teaching, that can put the teaching into practice. And so if we reflect on these things, our good fortune, there's a cause for happiness to arise in our own mind. And this is a very good thing for us to do, to reflect on our good fortune, to to rejoice in the good karma that we have made and be happy with our situation rather than to be miserable and looking at what's not here. Be happy about what is here and the opportunities that we have. But unless we make good use of those opportunities, then they're going to pass away. We're going to use up the accumulated good karma that we have. And so this is the next line in the verse, is to set oneself on the right path. And again, this is the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. Set oneself, not waiting for someone else to do it for us, not waiting for someone to push us or pull us, but doing it ourselves. And this involves, again, a reflection on where we want to go in this life. We all know that we're going to go eventually to death, but what do we want to have to show at the end of our time here? What is our deepest yearning? What is our aspiration, our highest aspiration for this life? Each one of us has to reflect on that, and whatever it is, work towards achieving it. And as the rest of this teaching will show you, the Buddha has given very clear instructions on how to do that. The next verses refer to the accumulation of worldly skills. And I love this aspect of the teaching also, because the Buddha was a very realistic teacher and very down to earth. And he knew that in order to live in this world and also to be able to practice, one needs basic supports. One needs to be able to look after oneself and live in this world. And so the next verse encourages us to develop our knowledge of the world, knowledge in experience of the world, to associate and take the time to go where we can learn. And not only to learn knowledge of the world, but also make ourselves available to learn spiritual aspects of life. But in this particular verse, he's also encouraging us to become proficient in skills, proficient in worldly skills, which are going to give us a livelihood. And one of the reasons why the Buddha encouraged people to develop worldly proficiency and to develop talents that they had is because that's a great source of self-confidence and self-respect. If one is able to do something, then one can be pleased with that. One can develop a sense of being useful, contributing, being a part of. So self-confidence and self-respect come from developing one's skills and taking the opportunities that arise to develop new skills, never too old to learn something new. And this also makes us someone who's people are pleased to have around. Someone who can help out, can do this or do that, are always welcome in groups. And so this is a way of joining in, of being part of. And so this is something that all of us should reflect on, that it's not enough just to try to develop the spiritual path. We also have to develop some of these worldly skills. But that isn't enough to find peace and happiness. To find peace and happiness, we need to have the worldly skills and use them as a foundation, as an integral part of our life, but we have to go further. And the next verse, or the next line in the teaching, is to develop one's self-discipline. And this is where we start to challenge our self-centeredness, our desires, our desire to have things the way we want them to be, the pursuit of pleasure as the only goal in life. And in this teaching, the Buddha encouraged us to refrain from 10 unwholesome courses of action. And those of you who are familiar with the five precepts of a lay Buddhist you'll recognize them in this list. To refrain from harming living beings, to refrain from taking what is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct and exploiting others through sexual behaviour, to refrain from speech which is dishonest, speech which is harsh, speech which is divisive or tale-bearing, and speech which is frivolous, nonsense. Also to refrain from ill will and covetousness, and from wrong views. And wrong views start out with the idea that I'm the centre of the world and everything should serve me, and if it doesn't, it's a mistake. So from there we start to reflect on the realities of life. So this is refraining from those courses of action which bring suffering to ourselves and to others. And the next verse encourages us to actively cultivate speech which is lovely speech, speech which is kind and compassionate, which brings harmony wherever we go, which speaks truthfully but speaks kindly. And this is an interesting thing to reflect on, because speech is one of the main ways in which we relate to others. If you like, it's the way we communicate with others. It's the currency of our communication. And so particularly if we want to be well integrated in the social group, if we want to be able to foster good relationships, we need to develop skillful speech as an active skill that we develop, not just letting it happen by itself. The next verse talks about our obligations and relationships to those who are closest to us in this world. Supporting mother and father, and cherishing husband and wife and children. And this is interesting again to reflect on in the light of modern society, that in Buddhist terms, the family isn't just mum, dad and the kids, the nuclear family. The family is much bigger and wider and broader than that. It goes up to the previous generation at least, as well as into the next generation. And the Buddha said, when you fulfill your responsibilities to those who are your parents, as well as to those who are your children, then you are helping to foster harmony, not only in your own family, but in society generally. And he even goes further in the following verse when he talks about supporting relatives, a wider field, not just the immediate family, but recognising one's interconnection with and mutual obligation to those who form a wider circle of the family. But he didn't stop there in talking about this is where our responsibilities lie. Because, first of all, he talked about that we should engage in peaceful occupations. An occupation which helps us to live happily with what we're doing. Helps our mind to be at peace with what we're doing. Helps the body as much as possible to be at peace. The modern word stress comes to mind very easily when we think about trying to do a job that doesn't cause discomfort for body and mind. So if stress is playing itself out very much in our occupation, then it's bound to have an effect on the people that we live with. And again, the Buddha is pointing to the fact that we don't live in isolation. We live in relationship. We live dependent on others, and they live dependent on us. And so when we're looking at our occupation, we should see the effect that it has on the people with whom we share our lives. Obviously, we're not able to pick and choose absolutely what we're going to do, but we should be mindful of the effect that it has on those we live with. And in a previous talk, I talked about the five occupations which the Buddha said Buddhists shouldn't engage in, because they harm those who do them, and they also harm those who are involved in them or who are the recipients of them. And they are trading in weapons, trading in poison, trading in intoxicants, trading in the flesh of animals, and trading in human beings. And as I pointed out in that talk, most of these five prohibited trades make up the highest revenue earners for organised crime. And so there's no it's not a coincidence that that's the connection, because they're based on profit, and regardless of the suffering involved for the people who do them and the people who are the recipients of them. So these are five trades that shouldn't be engaged in, but we need to always reflect on what the effect of our occupation or our profession is having on ourselves and those around us. In the next verse, the Buddha encouraged liberality, generosity. Generosity not just to one's own kith and kin, but to the wider society as well. And he included in this verse people, encouraging people to engage in blameless activity. And blameless activity are those things which benefit a wide group of people, not just those who we're close to or the people we like. So this is an encouragement to engage in social service. And traditionally in Buddhist countries, this has been one of the things which people do. Things like building rest houses at junctions for travellers, putting out cool water for people to have access to as they travel. These were the traditional things that people did as social service activities, planting trees, building roads, those kinds of things, when there weren't governments or government departments to come around and do those things. Now, these days we have lots of support services in our community, but there are always needs that aren't fulfilled by those organisations. There are always people falling through the cracks of whatever is available. And so in this verse particularly, the Buddha encourages us to look out for those things that we can do which can help to fill those gaps. And this is very contrary to the wrong understanding that some people have, that Buddhists are very self-centred and they don't go out of their way to help others. And particularly it's often thrown at Theravada Buddhism, this kind of Buddhism, that practitioners are only interested in their own well-being. They're only interested in getting enlightened for themselves and they don't care about other people. But I think those of you who've been around the Buddhist society long enough will know that that's not true, and just the fact that we have a Buddhist society that's available for anyone to come to is a sign that certainly people don't do things just for their own benefit. But Buddhists generally are engaged in all kinds of social welfare activity and all sorts of things which are supportive of society, and this teaching comes directly from the Buddha himself. In this verse, the Buddha also encourages us to refrain from intoxicants, and that was one of the five precepts that wasn't mentioned earlier in the 10 unwholesome courses of action. So this one is again something which the Buddha said is for one's own suffering, to particularly when one becomes addicted, obviously, but even the fact that one is dependent on the lift that comes from the glass or two. That's something for us to reflect on. Why am I reaching for that? I like the taste. Well, other things taste like that too, but they don't intoxicate the mind. So the Buddha's directly in this teaching saying this is not something to be pursued, but reflect on it. Why do I do it? Why do I find this difficult to follow? As we move now through this teaching, we move from the social role and the social obligations that we have more directly into the cultivation of one's own personal qualities And in this teaching, as I said, the Buddha has given a teaching which makes us reflect on the place of pride in our life. Pride is that sense of being better than, higher than, superior to. And according to the teaching, one of the fetters that binds us to the wheel of birth and death is conceit, mano, which is conceiving of ourselves to be something particular that has an enduring quality, a core essence to it. And this is a fetter, the Buddha said, because we operate in terms of it in our relationships with the world, and we constantly create new karma and new results of that, new action, new results of that, based on this misconception of being a permanent, enduring entity of some particular kind. So, for example, we conceive of ourselves as being male or female, or Australian, or Asian, or Buddhist, or a nun, or a bank manager, or good or bad, or any of those labels. And then we judge ourselves in relationship to other people, better than, not as good as, worse than, same as. And so we are actually putting out this attitude which we have towards ourselves onto other people. And so in the practice, we're specifically trying to unravel this wrong view, this wrong understanding of who I am or what I take myself to be. And in this teaching, in the Mahamangala Sutta, the Buddha enumerates a number of qualities for us to try to cultivate, to develop in our own personal life. And these challenge this sense of who I am. And the first of these is reverence, or the ability to pay respect to someone else, to acknowledge that someone else knows more than I do. Doesn't mean that they're a better person, it means they know more than I do about a particular thing. And in the worldly life, when we're trying to acquire skills, or in the spiritual life, when we're trying to learn, to gain wisdom, if we have the attitude, I know better, then there's an immediate barrier to taking on new information and making it our own knowledge and experience. And so the ability to pay respect is again something that we have to reflect on in our own life. When the Buddha became fully enlightened, immediately after his enlightenment, he looked around with his wisdom eye to see who in the world was worthy of his respect, which teacher also knew what he knew. And as he surveyed the world, he could see that there wasn't another teacher who understood what he knew. He was fully enlightened. But the teaching, the Dharma, the truth which he had discovered, that was truly worthy of respect. And so he said, I will live my life revering the Dharma. So even the Buddha looked for something to pay respect to. For us to reflect on in our own life. The next quality which the Buddha encouraged us to see as a real blessing is humility. That's certainly not a very popular quality in today's popular culture. And humility is described as being like a snake with the fangs removed. Someone who's fairly docile. Someone who's malleable. Someone who's dutiful. Someone who does what's needed without expecting to be to being acknowledged, to being recognized, or to getting the best place because they've done this or that. Again, how open are we to even considering that humility is a quality which might be good to have, rather than a sign of weakness? If you think about the people that we admire in the world, the people that we truly remember after their time of notoriety or fame or success, which are the ones that really endure in our memory? Which are the ones which we really get a good feeling about when we bring them to mind? And very often it's the people who didn't make a big show about themselves, who did what they had to do because it had to be done. Can we do that? Sometimes we can make a show of being so humble. And that's something to look at too. That can catch us out sometimes. The next quality is contentment. Satisfaction, to be satisfied. To be satisfied with what we have. And to know the word enough. This is enough. Someone said to me once, their practice was almost entirely trying to understand this is enough. Trying to be able to say, this is enough. I have enough. I don't need it. I have enough. So we can take one of these qualities, one of the ones perhaps that really makes our hair stand on end when we think, yuck, contentment, humility, where does that fit in? And see whether we find it difficult to include that in our life. Someone was saying to me recently that they were surprised at how materialistic the Buddha's teaching was, and that there seemed to be this lack of contentment or satisfaction. And the Buddha, again, was very practical. He understood that one can't put one's attention on the Dharma if one doesn't have the basic requisites of life. And so the basic requisites of life, the Buddha said, are food, clothing, shelter and medicine. And they're the four requisites that monks and nuns are offered by faithful lay supporters. And they're the same basics that we all need. And so we need to reflect in our own life, well, what's enough? So that I don't have to live with discomfort, I'm not living in poverty, but that I'm not also harassed or worried about the things that I have to look after. How much trouble it takes to take care of those things or protect those things or look after those things or pay for those things. So this is again for all of us to reflect on in our own life. The Buddha said that hunger is the greatest disease. One can't pay attention to the Dharma if one is hungry. So we don't go to the other extreme of just living without the necessary comforts, but we find the middle way when enough is enough. The next quality the Buddha said that we should develop is gratitude. And gratitude is the Pali word for it, means knowing what has been done. The Buddha said there are two things which are difficult, two kinds of people that are difficult to find in this world. One is a person who will do something for another. And the second is the person who will remember what has been done for them. And if we reflect on this, we can see that gratitude starts with mum and dad. We're all here because not only of our karma, but because we found a nest to roost in through mother and father. And so gratitude is one of the important qualities that we learn from the ground up, if you like. And it has two aspects. Gratitude is the passive aspect of remembering what has been done, but also expressing appreciation for it. And this is very often where we fall short. Oh yeah, they were really nice. But have we ever done anything to show them that we appreciated what they did or to repay them, return what they've offered to us, whoever they were, friends, neighbours, colleagues, family. So to get out and do something to express our gratitude, and maybe not even to specific people, maybe get involved in some kind of activity that supports others, because we've been supported. No personal connection at all. And this is also part of this teaching, that the Buddha is constantly encouraging us to widen our horizons, to move beyond that small circle of people who are our near and dear ones, the ones we like, to try to embrace the wider society and spread our goodness around so that more people will benefit from it. The next quality which the Buddha encouraged us to develop is obedience. Obedience, the ability to be corrected, the willingness to be corrected, the willingness to have someone else tell us, no, that's not that to happen, to submit to someone else without getting angry, without being silently sullen about what someone has said to us, without looking for their faults so that we can attack them, so that we don't have to receive what it is that they're saying to us. These are all qualities which depend on making an even deeper commitment to being willing to work with our own inner life, a deeper commitment to being willing to develop those qualities which go against the grain, but in order to open our heart to the spiritual life. We can see as we encounter any resistance to these kinds of personal qualities that these are the things which are the barriers which are supporting our conceit, supporting this wrong view of who I am. And so it's great if they challenge us. It's great if they sound terrible to us, because now we know where we have to pay some attention, what we've got to work with. As we move further on this path, as we start to really make a commitment to the teaching, the Buddha said in the next verse, we need to be vigilant. We need to be able to make sure that we don't lose ground by giving way to our desires, by being driven by our search for sensual gratification. At the same time, we need to put in the effort to build up those good qualities which are going to give us peace and happiness, internal peace and happiness that comes from a feeling of blamelessness, a feeling of self-respect, a feeling of confidence through knowing that we're doing the best we can, by living the best life we can. And as we move towards the tail end of this teaching, we find that we get to a point where one of the qualities that the Buddha encourages us to develop is tapo, which is the word for heat. And this is where we get to the point where we really want to turn up the heat on our practice. And to do that, we need supporting conditions. And in this teaching, the Buddha says the supporting conditions are timely hearing of the Dharma, timely discussion of the Dharma, and going to see those who are leading the samana life, the monastic life. Because if we don't avail ourselves of the opportunity to go to hear the Dharma and to discuss the Dharma and to be around those who are living this life, then we're always going to be getting the input from the world which says that to fulfill one's desires is where peace and happiness lies. To get as much as you can and keep it for yourself is where safety lies. And the Buddha's teaching as those of you who have any understanding or knowledge of the Dharma will know, goes in the opposite direction. And so we need to go to hear the teaching so that we can reflect on it, investigate it, and examine it in the light of our own experience, not just taking the word of the Buddha or the word of the teachers as being true for me, examining it in our own experience. And the Buddha said there are times when one is really receptive to hear the teaching. At times when one is sick, for example, and one can really believe that this body is suffering, then not only that it has suffering, but it is suffering. Or when one is near death, because the teaching on impermanence is staring one in the face. Or when one has troubles and one doesn't know where to turn, nothing seems to work, that's the time when one is open to hearing the teaching and letting it really penetrate to the heart. And when one's been practicing meditation, this is the time when the mind is more peaceful, when the surface clutter has been cleared away, and when one is really able to hear what is being said. So we should reflect on these things when difficulties arise in our life, in our experience. This is the time when it's good to go to hear the Dharma, or to go and speak to someone that we trust as a friend who can help us to maybe overcome our difficulties or overcome our obstacles or doubts, because this is when we really want to get an answer. And to be around people who are practicing in this way encourages us to maybe test it out for ourselves. So on Vesak Day last week, quite a number of people took on the 8 precepts for the day. And those 8 precepts include complete celibacy and not eating after midday and not going out to watch the television or engage in any sort of entertainment for the rest of the day. And so this is the sort of inspiration that comes when we take the opportunity to go where the teaching can be heard and where other people are upholding the teaching. We get inspired to try it out for ourselves, keeping the 8 precepts from time to time or regularly, going on meditation retreats where we put aside the busyness of our ordinary daily life and commit ourselves fully to trying to develop that peaceful heart and understand reality at its deepest level. So as we turn up the heat on our practice, we also have the opportunity to burn up our defilements more quickly. Because if we always have things on the slow burner, then it's going to take a long time for us to get the job done. So it's very important and helpful from time to time to really stretch ourselves, to really push ourselves beyond what we think we can manage, beyond what we think is comfortable. And if we can't contemplate at this stage in our life, monastic life, at least to take the opportunity to put ourselves on the hot seat from time to time through taking the 8 precepts or going on retreat. And if we find that that is very helpful, then we may decide eventually to take up the brahmacharya life, which the Buddha encourages as one of the highest blessings, one of the best blessings in life. The brahmacharya life is the celibate life, the homeless life, the monastic life. And as I said, from time to time you can experiment with this in your own life as a layperson. And also come to the monastery and spend time in the monastery and see what it's like to be there in that kind of environment. And if one wants to penetrate deeply in the teaching, then in this progressive training, this is what we're heading towards. As we get towards the end of the sutta, we're heading towards the part of the teaching which is directly related to developing wisdom. And it's not to say that we can't develop wisdom before we get to this point, and it's not to say that we can't develop wisdom as a lay person, but if you look at the way that the teaching is presented, you can see that the more that you turn towards the realization of the truth, the more inevitably you turn away from, finding your peace and happiness in the worldly life. And so as we come to the last few verses of this teaching, the Buddha talks about the person who has developed deep insight into the Four Noble Truths, the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is craving, desire. And the way out of suffering is cultivation of the Noble Eightfold Path. And when one practices according to the instructions given by the teacher and given in this sutta, in this teaching, one comes to the point where one penetrates the Four Noble Truths for oneself, and one realizes the truth of Nibbana for oneself. And the outcome of that, and this is one of my favourite verses in the Buddha's teaching, is that one has a mind, that has a heart, that though touched by worldly circumstance, is never shaken. It remains sorrowless, stainless, and secure. Sorrowless, because there's no desire. There's nothing that it can lose that can give rise to sorrow, because it's understood completely the arising and passing away of all that we take to be me and mine. And there's no stain of passion that can be aroused, because there's no stain left, no desire left, no passion there that can be triggered by anything that's available in the world. And because of that, there's complete security. And in the final verse, the Buddha says, the mind that has come to this point, though touched by worldly circumstance, that doesn't mean that one's never going to have to deal with difficult or unpleasant circumstances again, either within this body or in the world, but one is never going to be shaken by them again. And so one becomes invincible, in the Buddha's word, invincible, wherever one goes, whatever one experiences. One is invincible and one experiences lasting happiness. And so through this progressive teaching, this progressive training, one comes from the very mundane level, through the worldly skills, through our relationships with those who are close to us, relationships with the wider society, relationships to ourselves at an increasingly challenging, deeper level, we come to a point of complete freedom from suffering. And so that's a wonderful fruit to receive from the teaching. And in this teaching, as I said, we started out looking for the good omens, the things that we could count on that would point us towards happiness, prosperity and safety. The Buddha said they don't come from outside, they come from inside, and they come from our own actions and the way that we relate in the world and the kind of world that we create for ourselves. If we go back to the original story that I started with, the man who saw me as a bad omen first thing in the morning, that's an example of someone allowing the world to act on them and losing confidence. But the Buddha is encouraging us to see that our life is an interaction with the world. So we receive some sort of input, we receive some sort of experience. How do we deal with it? If we're bound by superstition, if we're bound by looking for things outside ourselves to show the way, then it's very likely that we're going to lose confidence. We're going to feel that we've been put upon. We're going to lose our initiative. We're going to be fearful. But if we have inner confidence, if we have inner strength, if we know where we're heading in our life, then the passing obstacles that we encounter are going to be seen as just that. Certainly not always pleasant, but something that we know how to deal with because we've got the instructions of how to deal with it. So I encourage you to look into this teaching. You'll hear this sutta chanted many times in your life if you are around a Buddhist environment, and it's one of the very basic teachings, which seems to be very simple but is actually a wonderful guide for for our daily life and for the development of the whole of the path to the end, to Nibbana. So may this teaching help all of us in our practice, and may it help all of us to attain Nibbana. So I've gone over time. Does anyone have any questions that they might like to ask?